City Council will come to order. Carla, please call the roll.
Adams.
Here.
Leonard.
Here.
Saltzman. Sten. Potter.
Here. I'd like to remind folks that prior to offering public testimony to City Council, a lobbyist must declare which lobbying entity he or she is authorized to represent. There are two items carried over from yesterday's calendar because we did not have a quorum. One is the vote on the consent agenda, and then we have two votes on emergency items. So, Carla, please call the vote on the consent agenda.
Were there any pulls?
Did anybody wish to pull any from the consent agenda? Any person in this room wish to pull any item from the consent agenda? Please call the vote.
Adams?
Aye.
Leonard?
Aye.
Sten?
Aye.
Potter?
Aye. Please read item 1415.
Authorized intergovernmental agreement with the Washington State Department of Transportation for the Columbia River Crossing Project.
Please call the vote.
Adams?
Aye.
Leonard?
Aye.
Sten?
Aye.
Potter?
Aye. Please read 1419.
Extend security services contract with Pioneer Courthouse Square, Inc. and authorize payment of associated fees.
Please call the vote.
Adams?
Aye.
Leonard?
Aye.
Sten?
Aye.
Potter?
Aye. Please read the 2 p.m. time certain.
Item 1421.
Excuse me, did you?
Did we get the transportation one done?
Yeah. Yes.
Okay.
Yes, that was 1415.
1421. Terminate transit-oriented development and multiple unit housing limited tax abatements for certain properties no longer eligible for the program.
Staff?
Mayor, City Council, Keith Witkowski, Government Relations, Portland Development Commission. I'm joined by Andy Wilch, who's the PDC Housing Director, and Margarita Molina, who's one of the PDC councils. What I'm going to do is just basically open up and describe the item and then hand it off to Andy and give you a little bit of explanation of how the proceedings will go. There's two different resolutions. I think what we'd like to do is take each one, you know, in order fully through. These items are a product of the work that PDC and the city have been doing with the county over the last 9 months to essentially implement and clarify the limited tax abatement programs we have in place for residential homes, transit-oriented, single-family in this case. Andy can give you a quick overview of what those programs are about. They're state-approved, though, and what they do is if you're eligible and you receive them, you get basically 10 years where you don't have to pay property taxes, and then it goes back on the tax rolls. In working with the county over the past year and the new administration under Chair Wheeler, the county identified a number of areas where they wanted to see a greater focus on PDC. The product of today's hearing is essentially some of that greater focus, and one of the things they emphasized was for us to take a closer look at the modern compliance monitoring and compliance work that we did with these programs. So what we're going to do right now is you'll get a staff overview from Andy, some basic instructions from the legal staff. Then there'll be appeals from the affected parties to the extent that they're here, and then there can be Q&A with the staff followed by action, and then we'll take the next resolution. Andy.
Great. Good afternoon, Mr. Mayor, City Council, Andy Wilch, Director of Housing, Portland Development Commission. As you gentlemen are aware, there are five different tax abatement programs that the City of Portland administers: the nonprofit tax abatement program, the transit-oriented development tax abatement program, the new multiple-unit housing tax abatement program, the new single-family tax abatement program, and then the rental rehab tax abatement program. We're going to focus on three of those particular programs that all have a home ownership component to it, specifically the new single family housing construction under code 3.102, ownership projects. There are criteria set by code, and there are specific mandatory general requirements for those projects. They must be owner occupied. They must meet a certain price point, and the compliance dictates there must be verification at change of purchase. On the other set of tax abatements that are homeownership tax abatements, which are the new multiple unit housing tax abatement, has both a rental and an ownership component, as well as the transit-oriented development tax abatement, which has both rental and ownership. Both of those programs have specific requirements for public benefits. They both have specific requirements for affordability, compliance, and reporting as it relates to ensuring that they are owner-occupied as a principal residence. With that said, I think I'll turn it over to Margarita to talk about the two programs as it relates to the request before you today.
As Keith mentioned, PDC has been working with the county. And as a result of auditing all of the current limited tax abatements, we identified 109 properties where they either we needed to verify whether they met the income limits or that they were owner-occupied. PDC has taken a very straightforward approach to owner-occupy, that the owner needs to occupy the unit. Of those 109 properties that we identified, we 59 of the 109 properties submitted information saying that they satisfied the criteria. So we had 50 properties where we could not verify that the owner was occupying the unit or that they met the income limits. So the resolution you have before you for item 1421, the first page of Exhibit A provides the 21 transit-oriented abatements that we have not verified the criteria. And page 2 is the 29 multifamily abatements that are in the same position. And today is an opportunity for the homeowners to appear before the council and show cause why those abatements should not be terminated.
What does the code say? That it has to be owner-occupied and no more than 100% of median income for a family of four as
right.
an income criteria.
And the way that PDC has interpreted owner-occupied is that the deed holder needs to occupy the unit. Some of the appeals you'll hear today, I believe there are family members that are occupying the unit, and PDC, therefore, was proposing termination.
Who are these programs designed for?
Single-family new construction program was designed as a revitalization program in specific target areas as defined by the city. As the program's evolved over the years, it's also turned into a moderate home ownership program as well. Ergo, the price point cap and the income cap and the owner-occupied provision. The other programs, the transit-oriented development and the new multiple unit, are, as I said earlier, it can be rental or ownership, but they are more for central city types of programs and or eligible in URAs or within, in the case of the transit-oriented development program, within 3 blocks from a eligible transit, 300 feet actually, from an eligible transit facility. They are high density in nature generally. They have home ownership, and they really are about increasing density at transit nodes and in the urban core and in areas designated for high-density development.
Thank you.
When you have a sale of one of these properties that are intended to be owner-occupied, you've said that you've interpreted that to mean that the owner of the property has to live there. Are there any documents signed by
for the single family, there is a subsequent home buyer.
Let me finish my question. Are there any documents that purchasers sign at the time that they the transaction is completed?
When the abatement is first granted.
So when they and I'm not sure how the transactions occur, but at some point I'm assuming there's a closing on the property and they sit down and sign a series of documents. Is there a PDC generated document that outlines conditions under which the purchaser bought the home, including the conditions of who is allowed to be in the home?
As it relates to the initial purchase.
I mean, is that when you grant the abatement?
The initial purchase, new construction, so the first buyer of that unit would have to pass the tests, and there would be recorded documents that would regulate the nature of the income of the individual and the obligations. And then the clause on the reversion, the due on sale clause?
I guess what I'm just asking, you've said you've interpreted the conditions to mean that individuals who buy the home have to live in it. Isn't there something they sign that makes that clear that that's the requirement?
Correct.
Do you have those kinds of documents here that will be part of what we will hear from the appellants today?
I'm Ann Johnson with the Portland Development Commission or Neighborhood Housing Program, and so I can give you a little more detail on this. On new single-family new construction, there is now a subsequent home buyer notice that is signed and recorded against the property. So all of those, the people know when they buy, that's on the title report when they get that. However, going backwards into the multifamily and the Todds, that was not done on those properties.
So I'm just trying to figure out on these properties that we're going to hear about today, did these purchasers sign something that acknowledged what the conditions of the sale was?
Not on the multifamily and not on the Todds.
So
those did not exist back when these were actually granted initially. But on new ones going forward, those are in place.
I'm just specifically asking about these appeals.
Yeah. On the appeals that are here today for the multifamily and the Todds, no. Those were not on those properties.
So there's that? Excuse me.
There's nothing in writing that lays out what the conditions are to comply with the abatement they were granted.
Because the way the abatements were granted on those properties, the entire property is granted the abatement, then individual units have to qualify by whether they're a rental or a owner-occupied. So there was a big difference in how those were done. Most of the ones that are on this were done several years ago. I think thinking this through now, we are looking at implementing those kinds of notices that are filed against the title. But on these properties specifically here today, those notices were not filed.
Was there any written notice given as to the requirements for?
They were given to the original homeowner who got the original abatement, yes. They got a letter that says, here, this is what your abatement are. Here's the way that it has to be in order for it to continue. They may or may not have passed that on to their buyer.
So I guess I'm not clear about that then. I mean, I'm not clear that I'm just, and these are just really basic questions, so don't assume I know a lot about this program.
Very
because
true.
I don't. So the folks we're hearing from today may not have been the original purchasers who understood what the conditions were that could have subsequent to that purchased the home. And did they buy it knowing there was an abatement attached to the home?
Many of them have told me that they bought it knowing that there was abatement. If they've contacted PDC to ask about it, then we will be happy to tell them what the conditions of them assuming that are. But many people just assume that the taxes are going to stay wherever they are at the moment.
Did we have any program throughout that period where an abatement was allowed that required any kind of a documentation from the owner that they still qualified for the abatement? I mean, that their income hadn't changed or whatever the conditions were that allowed.
Once the abatement is granted to the original owner, as long as they continue to own or occupy that unit, we do not re-verify income. But if they do not continue to occupy it, or if therefore that makes them ineligible, or if they sell it to someone new, then we need to verify the income of the person who purchased it new.
So if you need to do that and that didn't happen, what happened in there what didn't trigger that should have alerted you that the sale happened?
Okay, well, we should, at this point, we're setting up some very stringent monitoring things that were not in existence in the going backward. And we have come to realize that we need to be much more diligent about monitoring those. So we will yearly be monitoring these so that someone can't slip through the cracks as easily as some of these have.
And then when you're establishing these new procedures, are you also going to have monitoring of income levels?
Yes.
Recertifications?
Yeah.
And
Once a homeowner qualifies, there's no recertification of their income. If their income goes up, there is no recertification. They don't have to certify each year. But every time that the property changes hands, we will be monitoring that to make sure that we notify those people and that we have gotten income verification from the new owner.
Commissioner Leonard, excuse me, Mayor, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
To your question, I'm not sure if this answers just one other piece of information. The code is very specific about what happens when the property is transferred. It's not just a policy of PDC when it transfers. The code says when it transfers, it must also be sold to a home
household
earning no more than 100%. So it's not just their policy. So the written notice, you know, we would consider our code to be written notice as well.
Okay.
And then I think Ann answered it pretty well. The code only requires the 100% at the time of purchase. It does not, in fact, partly because it's a wealth creation type program, you only monitor it at that time.
But on that notice, the original notice to the initial home buyer asking for the tax abatement, is that provision of the code in the letter saying if it is resold, it has to be sold to someone
yes.
who qualifies for at the income level?
Yes.
So that the homeowner has that information
yes.
when they go to sell it?
Yes, they should know that when they sell it. They were all notified. That was all in the original notification letters. You have received the tax abatement for your property at. If you sell this, you need to sell it to a qualified home buyer in order for the abatement to continue.
There are different provisions for the single family program as it relates to compliance and criteria than there are from the transit-oriented development in the new multiple unit. They're under different chapters in the code and chartered under different statutory intent. Both of these codes have been changed and approved by this council within the last 5 years. And so there are now consistent themes in both programs. That is a mandatory income verification at the time of sale, a maximum sales price, and recorded deeds that go into place. Some of the changes in the multiple unit that happened since December of 2006 would verify that there is a extended use agreement, for instance, on the rental side, that you would have to have income qualification, must be owner-occupied, household of 100% median income for a family of four, and a price point, a sales price, I apologize, not greater than 95% of the FHA. So prior to December of last year, the program was different. But the program that I just read to you is the program that we're implementing now.
Okay, but I think the questions have been about what was in existence at the time these homes were sold. And let's just stick with the Todd one since we're going to take each of them separately.
Very good.
I don't know.
I would have to look at the specific.
What we're not trying to do here is have a policy discussion about
That's
what's
correct.
Right or wrong. What we're trying to understand is the basis under which we're going to make judgments on these cases. So it's helpful to hear what you're planning on doing in the future, but it's really not relevant to what we're doing right now.
All of the Todd units should have received a letter when they received the very first tax abatement that when it was sold to another owner that they needed to income qualify.
Do we have code that speaks to that
yes.
as well? And what does the code say in terms of change of ownership? Does it put any of the responsibility on the city or PDC to verify that the subsequent purchasers qualify?
No, the code is silent. It simply places a requirement, an income requirement. If it is sold, it must be sold to somebody earning no more than 100%, but does not provide for any monitoring.
How to verify that?
It's something we probably had to look at in the future. So.
Okay.
But it does say that you have to demonstrate the eligibility for the property tax exempt status on the section in the code dealing with a resale.
Yes.
And that the original owner is provided that information that the people must do that
yes.
who are purchasing the home.
Yeah, they should know that now. Sometimes that's 4 or 5 years and people tend to forget.
We don't put that on the deed or?
On the multifamily ones, it has not been put on the deed, but I think we're seriously looking at that being fixed.
Was this program designed to accommodate these homes as second homes so that there'd be another primary residence and that they could live there part-time?
No, it was intended to be a principal occupancy for the deed holder, the buyer.
And was any of the program designed to accommodate friends or relatives who would occupy in the absence of the person who signed up as the original buyer?
There's no provision for that. Owner occupation would be the deed holder, owner of record occupying the unit.
Other questions? Is that in terms of the presentation for the first 1421?
Yes.
Okay.
I just wanted to clarify, there's no action to go back. If somebody's been there for years, makes too much money, should be paying taxes. Nobody's going back after him. So it's a prospective.
It is prospective. It's in real time, current. It's not retroactive, no.
Hey, setting aside the issue of relatives, which I think is a different issue, I mean, the argument, if somebody bought it unknowingly, makes more money than qualifies for the program, lives there themselves, what they've gained is no taxes for several years that they shouldn't have got, but they're not going to have to pay that back.
Okay. And have you listened to each of the cases we're going to be hearing?
I've talked with each of these people, yes.
You guys have recommendations on each of the cases?
We are recommending that you terminate them all.
Oh, that's why they're here.
We're recommending termination.
Okay. And under the code, the city council is the one that hears the appeal.
Correct.
Yes.
I guess I misunderstood. I thought there were some that, but for some language, you would have allowed.
Right now, we're discussing the Todds and the multifamily, okay. Correct?
Yes.
There aren't any in that section, no.
Other questions? Thanks, folks.
Thank you.
How many folks have signed up for this 1421?
We have three people signed up.
Okay.
The first three would be Regina McCarthy, John Robertson, and Lou Robb. Please come up.
Thanks for being here today, folks. When you speak, please state your name for the record. I think under the circumstances, I'll waive the 3-minute rule, but do try to keep your presentation concise. Please proceed.
My name is Regina McCarthy, and I'm requesting that the tax abatement not be terminated. And the reason for that is back in 2003, my mother, Margaret McCarthy, who's here with me today, she was living at the St. James Apartments, and this condominium came for sale at the Cornerstone, which is the multiple family, which is what we're referring to now. And I was able to purchase that from my mother, and I was able to do that because there was the tax abatement. Now, I don't have any, there's no revenue on the property, as my mother is living on a fixed income, so I have a negative cash flow that helps offset that. And I purchased it because of the tax abatement, and it was never indicated to me in any documentation, which I have if you're interested in seeing, that it was never disclosed that there was that there would not be the tax abatement, and that there was no qualification for it. Indicated as well. So that's the reason that I purchased it, and it would be a terrible hardship if that tax abatement was rescinded before it was due to expire in 2010. And to go to your question earlier, it does say in the PDC letter that they will go back to the first time that I didn't qualify, which I've never qualified because I've never lived there and I never had any intentions of living there. And I indicated that, too, when I purchased the property.
So you were not told why you got a property tax abatement? That you were just lucky or what?
Well, that the property had a tax abatement through the year 2010.
And did they say the nature of the property tax abatement?
No, they didn't say that.
So how did you hear about the program?
Well, when my realtor had the multiple listing, it says on there that the tax is deferred. It says it right on the multiple listing document.
Did you buy it from somebody who got the original abatement?
Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So you didn't buy it directly from PDC?
No. I was a second owner.
Okay.
There, and it was, and all the seller's disclosure statement doesn't indicate that the tax abatement would.
Do you have the seller's disclosure statement?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Who was your real estate person that handled that transaction?
It was Realty Trust, the McNaughton Group.
Are they here today?
Oh, no. Mm.
Did you question as to why you get a tax abatement and no one else? You know, and this, most other folks in the city do not get tax abatements?
Well, I thought it was because of the property. I thought because it was an inner city property. I mean, that's why I thought there would be a tax abatement. Hmm. I didn't think it had to do with me as much as it had to do with the property.
And how long had the original owners owned the property?
I believe about 3 years. I think the property was built in 2000 with a 10-year abatement to the year 2010, and I bought it in December of 2003.
So do you know what the property taxes would be on it if it weren't abated?
I don't. My guess would be between $3,000 and $4,000, I would imagine.
What was the location again on the property?
It's on 12th and Jefferson.
And that's right. Inner city?
Yes.
And who lives at 1134 Jefferson? Is that the address of the property?
That is. That's my mother. My mother lives there.
And where do you live?
I live over in Northeast.
I guess I was trying to figure out what the impact is on the monthly payment if the taxes come out to be paid.
Right now, the taxes monthly are about $38, and I would think that would go to between $300 and $400.
How much is the value of the?
The property market? Is. I think I paid $187,000 for it 4 years ago, so it's probably worth more than that now. I haven't looked recently.
I think just off the top of my head, that'd be more like $250 or $275 a month.
Okay.
Is that the issue for you, having to pay that much more, or is the issue having to pay retroactive?
Both, because I already have a $400 negative cash flow in the property because of my mother's ability to pay, and the mortgage and the HOA dues have gone up significantly in the last 4 years, which, of course, you don't really have any control over. They've gone up $90 a month.
So you've heard the testimony before, and I mean, I believe you that you didn't know what the conditions were, especially since it was somebody else you bought it from. I can certainly understand how that would happen. But do you know that was an error now and that
yes,
that it actually violates our rules?
Absolutely.
Do you also understand we would try to find a middle ground where maybe we wouldn't, because you didn't know before, not make you pay the back taxes, but out of fairness, they need to be paid from this point on?
Sure.
My name is John Robertson. I was never notified that these requirements applied. We bought this condominium at 103rd and Northeast Clackamas in 2004. I have a daughter who's 46 years old, has an IQ of 68, has been classified as disabled by the Multnomah County Disability Services. And she's had a difficult life, and we've provided a lot of her support. Over time, it became more difficult for her to find jobs or to even find any work. And probably for the last 5 years, we've been her primary support and paid all of her expenses except when she had a job for a short time. The thing was that we needed to find a place to keep her off the street. And we found this condo and decided to purchase it for her. And the condo is in the name of a family trust. I consider that she's a family member and she's the permanent resident and the only resident. And the family owns it because in her mental capacity, she certainly doesn't qualify for having a mortgage and maintaining that. Also, she is not able to handle money, and I'm quite concerned about what would happen if she had property titled in her name. She's presently unemployed. She was employed by Habilitation Incorporated as a janitor in the public school, Portland Public Schools, until they lost the contract and she was terminated. Her unemployment will run out next spring, and she'll have zero income at that point and will again be paying all of her living expenses, food and housing and everything, at least unless we want her to go on the street. Part of the reason for getting this house for her was to keep her from being homeless. Tax abatement as being a requirement, I understood that it was tax abatement, as this lady next to me said. My understanding was about the same. The building was built with a tax abatement as an incentive to build and occupy these homes. That's all. No one ever spoke to me about requirements, and I never met the previous owner who lives out of state. It was all handled by mail. So I received no notice of my requirements. I did understand that it was supposed to be owner-occupied. It was an understanding, and I'm not sure where I got the understanding, but I didn't have any papers that I signed. However, we considered it was owner-occupied because we were putting a family in there, and the family owned it. Since we've had this residence and we received the notice that the abatement was to be withdrawn, I was also told, as you heard, that they were going to ask for all the taxes, back taxes on it. That would be a significant problem. My wife and I are retired on a fixed income. We do have an income greater than the minimum level, about $10,000 more a year than the $67,000 or so that's allowed. But my daughter, who lives there, has no income, essentially. And I would like to ask that the tax abatement not be terminated. Thank you.
How long is left on that one?
2 years.
2 years.
So I'm just curious, in the conditions that you're describing, your daughter's dependent upon you?
Yes.
I wonder if the PDC can help us understand that. Is there some, it sounds to me like there might be some format under which a trustee or a guardian could oversee an adult who'd otherwise own the property but for some incapacity that would allow for a guardian and a trustee. Is that something you can respond to, or maybe the council can respond to?
Andy, could you come up and can one of you folks share the?
Ms. Robertson, you can probably go
and do this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you. And you should stay, Mr. McCarthy.
Mr. McCarthy.
Mr. McCarthy.
That's Robertson.
Or Robertson.
Right. Robert, I'm sorry, Mr. Robertson. I'm sorry.
Andy Wilch, PDC. There's no provision for that kind of accommodation, though it's not prohibited. And so I would look to the legal counsel.
I'm not an attorney, so I don't think I articulated that very well. I want to articulate it this way. If just take these circumstances, set them aside, if one were to have an adult child that had some handicaps, whatever they may be, that required some monitoring by a trustee or a ward or something like that, ordinarily one would not have that individual writing checks, being responsible for paying the mortgage and what. I know that because I've been in that situation myself in my own family. Is the potential solution here to establish some kind of a relationship like that? And I'm sure this is a question for one of the attorneys, whereby you, Mr. Robertson, would be the guardian of your daughter, and so we could have an arrangement whereby, yes, you bought the property, but you bought it on behalf of her. She's actually the owner, but you're, I'm assuming, bequeathing that to her. For all intents and purposes, it's hers, but you're making the payment for her. Is that correct?
We've set up a trust and a trust for her in our will.
Okay. So I'm just asking for some help here. Is there some way that could be addressed?
I'll take a cut at it. Currently, the Todd new multiple unit housing programs do not have a hardship exception for the owner occupancy requirement.
That's really not my question. My question is, if she has resources to pay for it, and they're her resources, but because of her mental capacity, does not have the ability to enter into a contract herself. Isn't there some method by which she could have somebody appointed that be responsible for cutting the checks, for the payment? She's living there. Technically, she would be the owner-occupied person, but...
Presumably, yes, but I'm not hearing... I mean, I'm not an expert in trust, so we would certainly need to talk to somebody, but the trust relationships I'm familiar with and what he's suggested is the trust provides for in the will that upon his death, this will be held in trust for
her. And I'm understanding also we probably have to get you to do something more than what you've done now to manage the affairs of your daughter, but I'm just asking out loud, is that a potential solution?
The only other piece I'd add, aside from the owner occupancy requirement, we still have the income requirement.
But it sounds like she qualifies because of
the owner. I mean, that's the problem with the trust situation. The trust is the owner of the property, not that individual.
So. Or we could remedy that by making her the owner. I mean,
if she's,
but she can't enter into a contract.
And likely SSI benefits are affected
certainly
by...
Certainly this isn't the first time that this has been...
If I could make a suggestion, it might be that we hear the third case just so we can see what they all are. And then we've got a situation here, as I see it, where if there is agreement that we're not going after the back taxes...
What we put in front of you.
I think that's something we can put on the table now to everybody. So what we're really dealing with is... 2 years, 3 years so far of before you're going to have to start paying the taxes under any scenario. And I think everybody agrees that they knew that. I think we could probably, if the council had a result that it wanted for those 2 or 3 years, ask the attorney to figure out how to get it done rather than try and interpret the law, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. That sounds good.
But we got to figure out what we want to do first, I think, and... If we can't do it, we can't do it. But I think the council may have it. I'm getting from your questions that there may be a majority on the council that would like to have a certain result, and that maybe we should figure that out first. And
I just had one follow-up question for Mr. Robinson. You didn't buy the property originally.
No.
You bought it from somebody else.
I think it was bought in 2000, and we bought it in 2004.
Okay. Thank you.
I think the back taxes are a big deal to people because I don't think they have any reason to expect that.
Yeah.
And so we're really talking about the difference of the abatement running out 2 years sooner rather than it is running out. These are 10-year abatements.
Right.
Did you have anything else, Mr. Robertson?
No.
Okay. Could you state your name for the record, please?
Name's Lou Ropp. Mine's fairly simple. It's more of a terminology as to owner-occupied versus primary residence. I live in Bend, Oregon. That's my primary residence, but I do use this. I always have used it as my Portland residence. And their termination is based on the fact that it's not my primary residence. It's got 4 years, 4.5 years left to go. It's a studio apartment. It's about 340 square feet. It's about the size of a single car garage. So it doesn't mowed well with exactly a primary residence, but it is owner-occupied, always has been. It's never been rented.
You meet the income qualifications?
Yes. Yes, that...
So the only issue has been it's not your primary residence.
Right. It's just that they interpret the owner-occupied to mean primary residence.
And a 300 square foot condo. What would the property taxes be if it were not abated?
$900,000 more probably.
A year.
Yes.
Yeah. So is your issue more with the retroactive than a prospective?
That as well as I feel like I am in compliance with being owner occupied, and the income requirements. I meet the requirements. If primary residence is the issue, then that should be so stated in the code, and it's not.
Did you buy the home originally with the abatement, or did you buy it from somebody?
I was aware of the abatement. That's one reason I bought it. I was second owner about 6 months after it was first bought.
You were the second owner?
Yes.
And did you own the house in Bend when you bought it?
Yes.
And would you, I mean, just, I don't want to put you in a bad spot, but would your common sense tell you that, that the city would give away taxes to promote second homes?
I was under the assumption that it was more the redevelopment incentive.
To get that property there?
Yes. Yeah. Okay. Not the second home type.
It wouldn't matter who lived there, essentially. So under that theory, it wouldn't really matter who was there. It was just retreat.
Right.
And I mean, in fairness to your point, and I'm asking the question for an obvious reason, but in fairness to your point, we have given tax abatements for that reason in the past. We no longer do.
And there are state programs that do the same thing.
Yeah, it's not an unreasonable position. We do abate tax. We have when the economy was worse, we did abate taxes just to get buildings built, regardless of income. So it's not unheard of.
Mm-hmm.
Do you rent the property, or does anybody else live there besides you?
No, I've never rented it. It's always been personal use. Owner occupied. Yeah.
How many months a year do you spend there?
Not that much. It varies. It's really only a couple days a month at the most. It's more of a motel room setup type thing. But I do park my car there. I use the transit going to the airport. It's a good place. It's just very small. It's like a motel room.
Further questions? Did you have anything else to add, Mr. Rope?
That's it.
Thank you. Thank you. Discussion?
I did have a question for Lindley. I'm trying to think what my question is. Is the term owner-occupant a legal term that you can give us a definition, or is it something that the council has the room to interpret what it means, and the obvious interpretation of that is on the deed? Does that make sense as a question?
And I'll also ask Margarita from PDC, since she works with these abatements even more frequently than I. I do not believe it's a legal term of art. It is a term we've used. It is not, and correct me if I'm wrong, it is not a requirement of the statute. So we don't have a statutory guidance as to what it means. We do have a history of a number of years of, because some of the other programs, we've interpreted it in denying applications or terminating abatements, that it does mean primary residence. But it is certainly a matter of council's code. Council can interpret it. Is there anything I'm missing in terms of statutory definitions? Okay.
I guess from my perspective, I see a couple different categories here, and all probably created by a lack of adequate process on the city's part. I think that it would be unfair, given the lack of adequate process on our part, to, as Mr. Sten has alluded to, ask people to retroactively pay up till now property taxes that weren't collected, that I believe every person that was here didn't honestly think they had to pay. I've seen those same ads in the paper, and they're often advertised, and probably not the same programs, but the historic tax credits and others is pay no taxes for the next 10 years and whatnot. I think that's a very reasonable thing to conclude, that people expected not to have to pay taxes because of the property, not their income. So that helps me get to the place where I don't think any of these three appealants reasonably should be expected to retroactively go back and pay. So I'm fine with that. I do think in the case of Ms. McCarthy and Mr. Rope, just speaking for myself, that although that was a mistake, we're all aware now from this point on that these properties should pay tax. And I think that probably from now to the expiration of whenever it was you thought you weren't going to pay, that you should probably have to pay the taxes. Understanding, as I'm sure you do, also those are deductible from your income tax, so you do get a benefit there. But I do think, out of fairness, you should pay from this point on. The case to Mr. Robertson doesn't feel that clear-cut to me. Mr. Robertson has a disabled daughter that, on her own, I think would qualify, based on her income, were the property in her name for this abatement. And I think but for him trying to manage her affairs and help her, she would have qualified on her own for this abatement. And I would like to explore some remedy, even if it means adopting code language to acknowledge those kinds of circumstances.
And tell me if I'm wrong here, Lynn. I don't think whatever we wanted to do on these three based on that question I just got on owner occupancy, we would need to rewrite the code. I think that the program has been fixed. It was sloppy at best, and it's been fixed. I think everybody who's bought these will not have this case to make in the future, and that the future goes back a couple of years. So I don't think we'll see this ever again. It's a one-time situation in terms of the notification's clear, and I think we have now defined, for good or for bad, I mean, many people do support disabled relatives, and it's a hard thing to do, but this won't be available for that in the future. My feeling, though, is that it was so unclear, and on the scale of things, we're talking about 2 or 3 years left, that I'm inclined to essentially say when they went into this, that's a reasonable interpretation of it, so to grant their appeal. When I look at it, I assume that everybody who did not take the time to appeal to counsel accepts the finding. And for the other 50 properties, they got a free ride that they shouldn't have got, and they know that, or they wouldn't have come in. But on these, I'm not so sure about the second home. I'm just thinking out loud. The second home one I'm having a harder time with. I'm not quite drawing as great a distinction between the other two, because I think Ms. McCarthy's mom would have qualified on her own.
Is that accurate?
So
she qualified to live in St. James, which is HUD housing. So she would qualify.
And she actually moved from St. James, which we're probably subsidizing as taxpayers more than, and it's a wonderful place, and we're glad you're there and glad you're here. I mean, I'm just saying, my point being, she was living in housing that the city was supporting before that. It feels like a reasonable mistake to me, and sort of the, I'm just kind of getting at harm versus remedy.
I want to come down as like the Grinch here, yeah. But.
Go ahead.
It is Christmas season.
I kind of like being Santa Claus.
But the problem, I mean, and on the merits of everybody, including, I really appreciated Mr. Rope. Where's Mr. Rope?
Robertson.
Your Rope. Well, Mr. Rope, I appreciated your candor and honesty. You said you a couple days a month. It's more like a motel. That's actually very helpful to find a solution, because you weren't at all trying to make it sound like it's more than what it is. So I appreciated that. But having said that, I mean, there could, I just don't want to set up a circumstance where in the future then somebody who's fairly wealthy buys a condo for a child who's going to Portland State, and, you know, the child doesn't have an income, so that child by him or herself wouldn't qualify, therefore I qualify for the abatement. And while I'm hearing what you're saying, I'm also recognizing we're setting up precedent that others may be able to use in the future.
No, because we're not. The only precedent I would argue for, but I don't think there's any precedent. The precedent would be a family, if there was a precedent, and I'm going to tell you why I think there's not, would be a family member.
I want you to persuade me.
Yeah, it would be a family member who meets the income guidelines, and a unit at which there's no other income being made off of it. So it's essentially an extension of the family. The reason there's no precedent is these are not statutory requirements to the tax abatement. We could set up a program to abate taxes on transit-oriented development with much looser income requirements. And so my argument would be that's been fixed. Our transit program no longer will allow these, and we could change it next year to allow it. That's our discretion. So there's no precedent, because we changed the rules on these programs under the state law to fit the economic climate. And so my feeling has been, when you're in a sustained period where housing is not being built in the city limits for a variety of reasons, it makes sense for city councils to be looser with tax abatements. In this climate, where there's a very heated housing market, we should only do strictly income qualified tax abatements. We've made that change. So even if there were a precedent, it won't fly anymore, because that's not what the rules say. In this case, I think the mother and the daughter are a reasonable interpretation of the rules as they were being laid out at that time. I mean, I think a reasonable person would have concluded.
And I agree.
If I buy this property, make no income off it, we're not talking about a third cousin, a direct, a daughter, a mother live in it, that should qualify. And nobody told them otherwise or notified them that that wouldn't even be the case. And I think a reasonable person would think that. And we're talking about 2 years, so they got to pay the taxes anyway.
So I just need to hear from the city attorney. Is that a reasonable position for us to take, and one that we don't have to worry sets up some condition under which in the future a very wealthy family buys a tax-abated condo for their child to go to school and doesn't pay taxes?
The challenge is that this council, it doesn't get these very often. So if you make an interpretation of the code here, it is certainly one that's going to carry through until we change the code again, at least from the staff is going, unless you're very clear in your guidance of, we just think people were mistaken. They violated the code, but we think they're mistaken and we're not going to penalize them for that. That's different than we're interpreting these terms and our code to mean something, and until you change it, staff's going to have to interpret it that way.
So actually, Commissioner Sten's interpretation would create less of a precedent than mine. I mean, if we did what I'm suggesting, maybe that would create some opportunity.
But now the program guidelines have been changed, right, as well as the notification.
Changed how?
Andy Wilch, the one thing that has not been changed that we're bringing back to you is to record a specific document that would, at resale, for instance, cause there to be a trigger that would prevent any miscommunication, lack of information for the subsequent buyer.
What, Andy, what has been changed?
What has been changed?
Yeah. I mean, is there code language, documents, administrative rules? What?
Specifically, post-December of last year, that's rental ownership. General requirements per the code must be owner-occupied. Properties must be sold to a household at or below 100%.
What is that you're reading from? Are those rules you got?
These are the code provisions.
Code provisions, city code?
Yes, sir.
So is that something we've adopted?
Yes.
So that's been post last December?
Correct.
Okay.
So my name is Shelley Hack. I manage the Neighborhood Housing Program with PDC. Some of the changes that we've made as far as moving forward, these properties that you're being presented with today were approved through city ordinances of the past. There were not regulatory agreements recorded against these properties, but there was the ordinance was passed, and then there's a city code that governs how those programs are implemented. Moving forward, as we look at approval of new TOD programs and new multifamily programs, we will be implementing a regulatory agreement that will be signed and recorded against the property at the point that the abatement is initially approved.
Will that assure that in each of these three cases, each of these three appeals are from people who purchased properties from their original purchases? Will that assure that in cases like this in the future they will be notified?
It will be recorded. It will be of public record. It would appear on the title policy or the preliminary title report when a purchaser would buy a property. So there
what
would
is
be,
that that would appear? What is it that would appear?
It would say regulatory agreement. It would be recorded against the property, similar to a mortgage would be recorded against the property.
I'm asking, what is it that they'll see that will signal I have to be at this income level or I don't qualify for the abatement?
Have to look at the preliminary title report. Will give them a listing of all of those liens that are recorded against the property. They will have to, through their own initiative, review that regulatory agreement, just as they would review any other document that was recorded against the property, and that is the notice that is where they would receive their notice. Now we will, as we're recording these things, we're playing around at the moment with what do we actually label this, so that there's the greatest likelihood that somebody will take the initiative to actually read the recorded document.
Well, why don't you have something in there where you're notified when somebody sells, that they're required to notify you if they sell, so you know that the new purchaser is aware of the conditions? Why wouldn't you have that put on the deed or something that requires?
It's a very good question. I'm not sure how we would legally affect that, but we can look into it.
Absolutely. We can do anything you want when you sell the property as a condition. They either agree to it or they don't. If one of the conditions of the sale is you have to notify us when you sell the property.
Right, but if we're not the owner of the property, we may not have the authority
put it on the
to
deed.
Do. But we can take a we can take a look at that. Definitely.
Just stays with the deed. You just put it on the deed. As a condition of the sale, the purchaser has agreed to notify the Portland Development Commission of any future sale.
And the escrow company.
Yeah. And that triggers you to go, why did they do that? Oh, okay, that's because of this set of conditions, and you tell the new purchaser, here are the conditions.
I think if I'm not
mistaken, if it's in the deed, then the escrow company would be required to notify the new seller of the expectation to contact PDC.
So my recommendation is before I'm, I guess, my suggestion is before I can accept this recommendation is that you agree that we'll change the process so you'll be notified as part of the sale of the property from the original purchaser to new purchasers such as this. I need you to agree that that's something you'll have to put in your processes.
And I would look to my legal counsel that if to the greatest degree that we can legally do that, most definitely, we will make those adjustments.
Okay.
Why don't we bring back? Okay. I mean, I'm just a little nervous about creating a legal mechanism on the fly, but let me work with PDC and come back with a strong recommendation.
Okay.
I guess
certainly.
I guess I might try my thought a different way, which would be that I am inclined, based on the testimony and the facts and all of the issues, and I think some negligence on the city's part in terms of how we argued this, to not seek any retroactive taxes from any of the parties, and to extend the abatement for the 2 or 3 years until it's natural, until it's end for the two units of the mother and the disabled daughter. And I would, if that was something other people agreed with, and I don't know if it is, I would ask the city attorney to find the best way to do that.
What about the third?
I'm not convinced on the second home.
Okay, so on those two, we would, okay.
Yeah.
All right.
I mean, I just think it's harder to
okay.
get to that one for me.
I'm fine.
And I could suggest different ways to do that, but maybe the attorneys could just.
I'm not sure what you're asking. I mean, if you want on the particular resolution you have, you can simply strike through the terminations for those two appellants who showed up, and you can strike those through. The only concern I have is simply making sure that it's clear on the record. We're going to have, during the terms of some of these abatements, additional sales. It was not clear to those two people who are buying, even if they would have gotten that notice, I don't think it would have been clear to them what owner-occupied meant. And so I'm not sure the notice you're talking about would have necessarily solved the problem. So that's a
well.
Sorry,
and so I think I think all future sales need to, have something that makes it clear. It needs to have a definition of owner occupant that in the future will not include relatives, even if they are in a deserving circumstance. I think also, you just have to balance these decisions based on the totality of the evidence. I think the fact that the council is now having a hearing debating all these things would weigh me to be less sympathetic the next time around. I just can't come up with any theory by which folks who put income-qualified relatives in there, which is a natural extension of their family, would have known this. Now, I think if it does come up again, I think there's more of an argument, more of a record, but I think we need to take stronger steps.
And I agree with that. Only I would want to make it clear that I think in both of those cases, the case of Ms. McCarthy and Mr. Robertson, simply how the sale was conducted. That is, had they purchased the property, understanding what the conditions were. In other words, Ms. McCarthy may have put the condo in her mom's name and lent her the money, and Mr. Robertson may have taken the kinds of steps so that he was actually acting on his daughter's behalf, I think they would have qualified on their own that way. So I guess maybe out of this, if somebody comes in and wants to engage in that same kind of a transaction on behalf of a parent or a child, we could be prepared to help them do the kinds of things. Because I wouldn't want to prevent this kind of thing from where a daughter's trying to help her mom and a dad's trying to help the daughter. I would not want to prevent that from happening. I don't think in these cases it would have been had they simply taken some other legal steps in terms of the relationship.
Well, with that clarity, if what you're suggesting and if it's counsel's desire, what you would simply do is subtract those who you wish to grant the appeal and then pass the resolution as to the others. And I would suggest that the motion include clarity about retroactivity, as you've stated, because that is not clear in the resolution.
Okay.
So that's in resolution number 1420.
So I would.